Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast often deals with graphic, violent, and horrific crimes against men, women, and children. Please listen at your own discretion. If you are affected by any of the themes featured in this episode, please contact your local support charity.
It was a very, very unusual type of case. I don't think we'd ever had a case similar to that in Hong Kong before.
Some people were saying, could there be a serial killer, you know, lurking around in the area?
The culprits had obviously tried to destroy certain items of evidential value.
We didn't find any important evidence that would help us lead to who the killers were.
Very little evidence to go on the scene because obviously there's no witnesses.
And it could be anybody.
The most notorious murder in Hong Kong.
This was Baymar Hill.
Catching Worms, a Hong Kong true crime podcast. Nicola Myers and Kenneth McBride met at Island School. Nicola joined the school in the fourth form and was placed in the same house as Kenneth, the House of Fleming, named after the Scottish doctor Alexander Fleming, who discovered penicillin. A strong friendship had developed between sporty Kenneth McBride and the pretty and intelligent Nicola Myers. They were in the upper sixth, studying for their exams, and one Saturday afternoon, they decided to take their books up to the top of Braemar Hill to revise and take in the scenic views. They did not know this would be the very last time they would take that walk. They had plans for the rest of the weekend, as their teacher from Island School, Chris Force, remembers.
He was in the debates, school debate team that just won through to the final of the Hong Kong school debating competition. That was going to follow in about 2 weeks. In fact, Kenneth and Nicola were both due at my apartment on the Sunday night, April 21st, where we were going to have our brainstorm for the debate final.
No one had a bad word to say about them, as Detective Nora McKillop discovered.
They were very, 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 very popular young students at Island School, both of them. They were very active in the socially in the clubs and extracurricular activities. They were good at sports. Kenneth was a very popular young man.
So he was very argumentative, quite bolshy, very bright. Big debater. He was captain of the Island School rowing team. In fact, he had won an international meet just a few weeks before he was killed, actually, in Japan. So he's top rower. And yeah, just, yeah, as I said, he was elected by his peers to be student union president. So that says something.
Yeah, they were top students back in Ireland school, and they were studying for the A-level exams.
So young.
Yeah, very young. Yeah. Very kids.
Very young and full of life until, on the 20th of April, 1985, that life was taken from them. When they didn't return home after their study date, their parents began to worry and reported them missing to the police. The next morning, their bodies were discovered by a jogger on the hillside. Their teacher, Chris Force, was left with the task of telling their classmates what had happened.
But we had that meeting that evening. I managed to get to most of them on the telephone and explain what had happened, and that we would still gather at my apartment that evening. Because fundamentally, the students needed to be together, to share. Some students didn't know when they walked into my apartment what had happened. Some screamed.
Two detectives led the investigation.
We were on call and we were the first ones, and so I was the OC case to start. And then because of the sheer volume of stuff that had to be done, Norrie and his team came on board, so we handled it together, dealing with different aspects of the case. And in fact, Norrie was dealing with the McBrides whilst I was dealing with the Myers. So we had that sort of personal touch with the two families.
Scottish-born Norrie MacKillop was working for the Royal Hong Kong Police as a detective for the Organised and Serious Crime Squad when he was assigned the case. Working with him was Londoner Detective Trevor Collins. Their memories of events overlap as they describe the evidence they found at the scene.
One peculiar thing was Kenneth's shoes were missing. So we found that quite peculiar. But items of clothing, books and study material were scattered around.
We found a lot of the pair's school books and such that had been torn and torn up and thrown away. You know, he was just looking for whatever you could find. We found a number of items which were going to prove, as we knew at the time, difficult to deal with, because you had like a piece of wood.
Now, the murder weapon on that day, strangely enough, I found it myself, which was quite extraordinary, given the number of people that were there. I walked down a valley while other inquiries were going. I took a stroll around the area to make sure that I got a thorough idea of the whole area.
This is Detective Norrie MacKillop, the first detective you heard earlier, with the help of his cat in the background.
So I walked out with Peter Yip-Pau-Fuk, one of my inspectors, and we took a walk around the area. We walked down a valley where there was a stream, and I noticed a piece of wood in the stream, and the end of the wood didn't look consistent with there was material, or earth, I would say, discoloured earth on the end of this piece of stick, probably about a foot and a half long, about probably 2 inches wide. It's quite a hefty piece of stick. But the end of it had some discoloured earth on it, which wasn't consistent with having laid in the pool for some time. So I took it out, and we used the term seized. It's just a term that we used to show that we bag it and we stop it from being contaminated. And that, in fact, turned out to be the murder weapon, or one of the murder weapons. It was just quite extraordinary in that area to be found.
And in that piece of wood, there was a fingerprint. It was in blood and mud, and there was a hair trapped inside the fingerprint as well. And you've got to remember, in those days, there was no such thing as DNA and such like. And it was always difficult to decide amongst the experts who was going to get the first bite, as it were. And if you gave it to the fingerprint people, they would probably destroy the blood and the hair aspect. And likewise, if you gave it to the what now called forensic scientists, the chemists, as they were called in those days, then you'd lose the fingerprint. So that was a bit of a quandary.
Dr. Robert Green was awarded an OBE for his services to forensic science, and with 30 years of practical on-the-ground policing as a specialist in applied forensic science and cold case reviews, I wanted to get a better understanding of how significant this evidence was.
To the level where you've just got a very small amount of evidence, say like one fingerprint.
Yes.
Is it possible to identify a suspect from just one fingerprint?
Indeed. In fact, you very, I'm going to say not seldom, but not oftentimes, you actually get a full sequence of finger marks. It's a, I suppose, classic textbook case where you're actually looking for someone climbing through a window and pulling themselves. So you get the four finger inverted sequence, but very often you find that fingerprint identifications are made very often on one digit, or in fact even on a fraction of one digit. So we're only looking now for a small part of the actual finger mark itself. So you don't even times need one digit. It's really all about the quality of the ridge detail. So it's all about not necessarily the amount of material, but actually what the quality of the finger mark is.
On the 1st of May, the South China Morning Post reported a significant forensic clue. Human tissue had been found under the fingernails of Nicola Myers. It was believed she had scratched one of the attackers in the struggle. But at the time, DNA testing was not available to the Hong Kong police. And without this, how significant was human tissue? Could it be used to trace the killer? The Hong Kong police would need the help from some of the best forensic scientists in the world. So Trevor Collins was sent to the UK.
We decided that we could make use of the British government forensic laboratories, the Home Office laboratories in London. So I took these exhibits to go over there because they were the first ones that had the laser examination technique, and we thought that perhaps that would be ideal for especially on the fingerprint and such like.
Dr. Robert Green was head of science and technology at the Home Office and explains what this laser technology involved.
Laser microdissection of items that were recovered from the body. And one of the techniques that was used was a technique called differential extraction from, let's say, a pair of underwear that's involved in a murder scene. And where, if I explain to you this way, you can have a microscope with a laser attached. You can actually look through the microscope, and you can effectively dissect the sperm head actually from the garment. So that's what laser microdissection is. And it enables you to be very specific about the number of sperm head that you find. In contrast to early techniques, the differential extraction was not as specific as that.
For Detective Noreen McKillop and Trevor Collins, the most important piece of evidence were the bodies themselves.
Oh, the body. Well, the state of the body had to be examined. Both bodies had to be examined in situ. Kenneth, you might recall, had a broken collarbone, so his arm was in a sling. The bodies were in a pretty bad condition. They'd been very, very badly beaten. And that was apparent from the outset. And of course, the forensic postmortem revealed lots more. Nicola, for example, had suffered hundreds of injuries, and Kenneth from what his body told us, had put up a terrific struggle, probably to try and save Nicola, apart from protecting himself.
With Nicola, she had over 550 injuries, which had to be recorded in a way that you to find out what was the cause of those injuries. And Kenneth had over 100 injuries on him. So each one could help in identifying certain aspects of how they were killed.
A post-mortem is a medical examination carried out on the body after death. It is also called an autopsy, which means to see for oneself. In a homicide, or any case where the cause of death is suspicious, a post-mortem autopsy is required. For Nicola, her family had to endure two post-mortems under the watchful eye of Detective Trevor Collins.
So there was a post-mortem in Hong Kong and there was also a post-mortem in the UK.
Yeah.
And you attended both post-mortems, did you?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Because there was a case in, I think it was Kenya, where it was a daughter of a policeman, actually, a UK policeman, who apparently fell off a balcony. It was ruled as a suicide, but witnesses claimed that it was a murder. The post-mortem in, I believe it was Kenya, the body was sent back to UK, and the father insisted that a second post-mortem was conducted, and as a result of that, they discovered it was probably murder. So the British government, or the English people, side of the government, turned around and said that every English person who has died overseas, the body was returned to England, then a second post-mortem would be carried out. So Nicola had a second post-mortem, but Kenneth didn't, because he went back to Scotland.
Although they had found a number of important forensic clues, the science was not developed enough, and there was not sufficient evidence to identify a suspect. Would they ever be able to find the Braemar Hill killers?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Nicola Myers and Kenneth McBride had gone to Braemar Hill to study one sunny Saturday afternoon in April 1985. 24 hours later, lines of police were scouring the hillside in search for any clues that could identify their killers. The police had found the murder weapon, a wooden stick. Items of clothing and school notebooks strewn across the shrub grassland of Braemar Hill.
I was head of history when the murders took place. Kenneth was in my A-level group. In fact, the notes of my lessons were actually found on the site.
The news of their death was slowly spreading. Chris Force, their teacher from Island School, had planned to spend that Sunday evening with Nicola and Kenneth, brainstorming for their inter-school debate competition. Instead, he invited their friends and classmates to his home to share the terrible news.
It was absolute shock. You could not believe the response, more often than not, it was just silence and just speechlessness. Because this was probably the most shocking event in Hong Kong of that era. And it's been recorded in the South China Morning Post history book as perhaps the greatest, the most notorious murder in Hong Kong.
After this initial shock, the students took a moment to remember their friends.
We began to exchange stories and remembered these two young people, remembered their quirkiness, the way they used to write poems to each other. I remember conducting one lesson up on the roof because it was a nice sunny day, and Kenneth came up with his desk because he was determined he was going to have something to write on.
Read by an actor, this is one of such poems Kenneth wrote to Nicola.
Together, Kenneth to Nicola. Essence of the precious hours spent with you shall never fade in the book of my memory. Your soul's faithful and selfless tranquility and the bright-eyed compassion it always knew shall never fade when I think of you. Together our wind-washed minds raced to the sea and soared above the nets of destiny. Together our strengths tempered as we grew. Beside you, time and pain would slip as our laughter and your gentle smile replaced the loneliness. Blown away over the green stones and brown earth, so much more than the sole sound of breathing. And though perhaps silence is the best communicator, I shall always smile and remember when I think of you.
Assigned to the case was homicide detective Norrie MacKillop. He and hundreds of officers had spent hours on the hillside looking for any evidence that might lead them to the killers. I asked if they'd found any footprints.
No, the ground wasn't really suitable for footprints. No, we didn't find any important evidence that would help us lead to who the killers were.
So, with no footprints, no obvious forensic evidence, they had to start looking for the suspect. Who were they? Why had they selected Nicola and Kenneth, these two friendly, bright young students from Island School? Who would want them dead and why?
Normally, well, often, victims know their killer.
Yes.
Was this the consideration?
No, it was. We always keep an open mind in any murder investigation, but this was not the. This would became very, very apparent to us that they were very, very popular young people amongst their peers and in school. So there would be no reason for anyone knowing them to attack them. There was no evidence of any love triangles or anything of that nature.
And were you originally thinking that you were looking for one killer?
No. Although Kenneth was his arm was in a sling, it was quite obvious that this would be, and the number of injuries. It was quite clear to us that we were looking for a minimum of. Minimum of three people involved in the killings.
But yeah, there wasn't any clear line of inquiries on who those three people could be initially.
No, there would be three or more people. We thought from the way the bodies were found, from the injuries, from the fact that Kenneth, despite his arm being in a sling, would have put up a terrific struggle, and Nicola also. And she was naked. It was quite clear that there was a sexual attack on her. So it would be very difficult for even two people to handle two fit young people like Kenneth and Nicola. So we're looking at a minimum of three people, probably more. But no clues at the time of the who might the perpetrators be.
And that carried on for a few months. They didn't have much information for a while, right?
No, didn't care. Yeah, didn't have any information at all.
Journalist Tony Flores was working for commercial radio at the time and reported on the case.
I mean, you would never imagine who would do such a thing. How can you do it?
It had been one of these cases that they talk of like a cold case, where now, because of DNA and forensics,
yes,
they might have been able to test something.
Right.
But at the time, they didn't have any
of that.
They
didn't have any information. Remember, nowadays we've got, I don't know whether it's a good thing or not, but you got so many closed-circuit TVs. Now the police rely heavily on closed-circuit TVs, you know, CCTVs, cameras, all over the place from shops. Then they can easily try and track down, you know, or find out who's been to the area and try and zero in on where they started and all that. In those days, you didn't get much of that. Not a lot of crimes. The police just go through the... They go to the shops, you know, can I borrow your CCTV, you know, your footage, your security camera, and they can find out, you know, they just follow them.
Whereas then they had none of this.
Yeah.
And up at Braemar Hill, you definitely wouldn't have.
You definitely would not, yeah.
Working alongside Detective Norrie MacKillop was his friend that he'd met over a decade earlier at the Hong Kong Police Training School, Detective Trevor Collins.
Do you remember what your initial working theories were, what you thought could have happened to them?
Well, I mean, it's obviously from the very beginning, it was a robbery gone wrong. It wasn't just a straightforward rape. It was just a, you know, the area, two kids out by themselves, two white kids by themselves. I mean, and remember, they're late teens, so they weren't youngsters. And obviously, if they were going to be targeted for robbery, then one would expect that the two expatriate people would have some money on them, which, as we know, they didn't. They had a dollar, or I believe that's all they had with them. Because that was my initial feeling, we had to then sort of look at how we were going to tackle the fact that the very little evidence to go on the scene, because obviously there's no witnesses, and there was obviously more than one person who did the things to them. So we were going to be looking at two or more individuals. So then we had to decide on whether they were robbery gangs or they were robbery gangs that always ended up with the sexual aspect, rape or whatever. So then we had to look at the whole of Hong Kong, which is another part of the story, obviously.
With this working theory, these two detectives needed the manpower to carry out their investigation.
I think we used the whole company of PTU, at least the whole company. That's four platoons. That's you know, well over 150 people, including detectives. So they had to be very carefully briefed to conduct thorough and systematic searches. And we made appeals for any witnesses who were in the area on that day or the day before that, even, just to find out. Over the following weeks and months, we tried to establish a pattern of who would be normally in that area. And if there was people who were normally in that area, who was not going back to that area. So that was one line of inquiry. But everyone that we discovered who had been in the area had to be eliminated as a suspect. So with lots and lots of lines of inquiry to follow up, apart from the obvious forensics.
But we didn't even have computers in those days. And if we were going to conduct the size of an investigation involving as many as we could identify, we would need some sort of assistance. Every single group of two or more people that were stopped and searched throughout Hong Kong obtained their details, identify and locate them, identify and then eliminate them or otherwise. At the same time, we started to interview and identify every single person in the area, all the way down to making sure that we had details of babies and prams, this kind of thing.
With a case so complex and with such little evidence to go on, public opinion was not in their favour, as journalist Tony Flores recalls.
I say that because people didn't think the police would ever crack the case because it happened on the hill. So many people go up there every day, morning joggers, hikers, and it could be anybody. A lot of people were questioning why you need so many police officers. Some were saying, is it because they were expatriate kids? They have more attention, but others, including some police officers that we spoke to, it's not a question of whether they were expatriate kids or not. They worry that because it was a very horrible murder, the two kids suffered multiple injuries, very evil attack on them. They were worried that whoever did that could do it again. That's why they were anxious to catch the killers. That's why they need so many police officers to try and find the person or persons who did it.
But how easy would this be? Could the police catch these killers? It was 1985. DNA testing was not available to the Hong Kong police. They just had one fingerprint. I returned to speak to Dr. Robert Green, specialist in forensic science, to get an understanding of the science available to them at the time.
It was very, very limited. It was, the only real biometric, I suppose we would call it, a biometric is one of those pieces of types of DNA which allows you to identify who the perpetrator is. The only one we had at the time was a fingerprint, which in those days was a very, very manual system. We'd do a year's worth of work. We would keep all the crimes in a book, and I'd highlight the ones which had been identified with forensic science, with fingerprints, as it was in those days. And I would probably do about 1,000 jobs per year, and look back on the 1st of January the following year, flick back through my book and think, I have just a handful of crimes that have been solved with fingerprints. So very limited, very labour intensive to actually match the finger marks. I suppose in those days, heavily reliant on police officers putting forward good suspects who could be checked against the marks.
But the police didn't have any suspects.
And because, as I said, in those days, then, nobody ever thought that the police would ever be able to catch the killers.
Next time on Catching Worms.
I would say about a minimum of 3 people involved in the killings. With Nicola, she had over 550 injuries.
And the stick was used as a brutal weapon.
But I know those kind of cases live on in Hong Kong's memory, so certainly lives on in mine.
He or more than one of them believes that they're less culpable than the ringleader. It preys on their mind, and sooner or later someone will talk, and with a bit of luck someone will overhear that talk, and that's exactly what happened in this case.
In memory of Nicola and Kenneth, the school set up the Nicola Myers and Kenneth McBride Memorial Fund. The fund aims to support underprivileged sixth formers from across Hong Kong. If you would like to give to the fund, please see the information in the show description. This has been a Create podcast. Make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button so you never miss an episode. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please leave us a review and a 5-star rating. It helps others to find us. you can follow us on Instagram at CatchingWormsHK. With special thanks to Detective Norrie MacKillop, Detective Trevor Collins, Chris Force, former teacher at Island School, Sean Ellis from Cinebrand, Robert Reed Kay, forensic specialist Dr. Robert Green, and journalist Tony Flores. And thank you for listening.
Catching worms. 쪽청. This term means to get yourself into trouble, causing unnecessary difficulties. It may seem like an odd phrase, but this slang is often used as an abbreviation of the full saying 쪽청엽시팟, that involves putting said worms up your rear end, which to anyone's imagination definitely spells trouble indeed.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.